you're visiting with us and need a copy of that lesson, we have some extras in the back. If you'd raise your hand, we'll bring one to you. I don't see any, Charlie. We've been looking at various things that Jesus said in his ministry, which I think have profound effects on our lives. That is, they teach us fundamentals by which we ought to live. And then we've expanded on those using the epistles and other letters to help us understand more fully that concept. This evening, we're going to look at relationships we have in our lives. There are five that Brother Cogdell mentions in his book, New Testament Church, Walking by Faith. He talks about the church and its relationships, the home and the family relationships, community, social relationships, business world, commerce, economy, and that sort of thing, and then government, that is civil relationships. We're going to look at three of those this evening. The two that we're not going to look at is community and business world. But I suggest the first one has application probably throughout all five of those areas. I'm sure there are others. Those are the ones he mentioned. They're the ones I'm going to look at. The first of these is spiritual relationships. We looked at this concept earlier about love God and love your fellow man. We're going to expand on that a little bit with respect to how we love the brethren, particularly those among us who are brothers and sisters in Christ. We're starting in John, the 15th chapter, beginning with verse 11. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. You are my friends, and if you do not do whatever I command you, no longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatever you ask in the name of my Father in my name, he may give you. These things I command you, that you love one another. We talked about this concept of love, meaning that we value other people so much so that we're willing to give whatever we have and whatever cost we have for their benefit. So we may expend ourselves in money, in time, in emotion, intellect. And Jesus says, what's the fullest extent of our giving ourselves for a friend? Lay down your life for another. In 1 John, the 4th chapter, John expands on that. Verse 7 says, Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love God does not know God, for God is love. In this, the love of God is manifested toward us, that God sent his only begotten Son into the world, that we might live through him. And this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. What's the primary example of the love so extensive that it lays down its life for someone else, in fact, for all other people? Jesus. Jesus came and lived here, experienced what it is to be a human, suffered at the hands of those who ridiculed him during his ministry, who were obtuse with what he was teaching, his own disciples, who contradicted him, called him names. And eventually the final insult against him was they crucified him. And why did he do all that? To obey the Father because he loved us. He was willing to do all of that because he was willing to give of himself, both living and dying, that we might benefit. And it's the ultimate benefit he could offer us, that is reconciliation back to God. To expand on that a little further, Paul says in Romans 13, verse 8, and this is respect to us now. Owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. If there's any other commandment, all are summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Getting back to what James said a moment ago, Jesus came to obey the Father. He came to keep the Father's commandments. But what is the intent, the purpose, and goal of God's law? Toward us. Right, it's our perfect benefit. But even if you drill down to the specific laws of the Old Testament, for example, the Ten Commandments listed here, when God says you shall love your neighbors yourself, that encompasses don't commit murder, don't steal, don't bear false witness, don't covet. Those are day-to-day things we can do or not do, and we do those because, and we don't do those because they contradict the concept of love. So if I want to belittle somebody, is that love? No, it's not from God. If we have excessive wrath, that's not the work of God. The principles that we read in the New Testament with respect to how we interact with one another are all based in the principle of love. We talked the other day, Sunday, about if someone does you wrong, what is your obligation? Go to him, get straightened out. If they do you wrong, or you do them wrong, what is your obligation? Go to straighten it out. That's a principle of love. That's owing no one anything other than to love them, as Paul says here. And therefore, we need to be expressive that way. Love does no harm to a neighbor. I'm going to extend this a little bit. I'm going to mention it now. I'll bring it back up in the next section. That relates to Christians particularly. I think it extends further than that. But our discussion this evening, that relates to Christians. So if you and I have an interaction, what should be fundamental in my thinking? When I speak to you, when I say things to you, when I do things for you or against you, fundamentally I should say, is this going to harm that person? Or in a positive point of view, is it going to help that person? And I'm going to extend that to the marriage relationship. Because very often we get so intimate in relationships such as marriage or brothers and sisters, close family members, that we think the other principle goes out the window. It holds even more so true in those intimate relationships. I'll come back and talk about that in a bit. 1 Peter 1, Peter adds, since you have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit in sincere love of the brethren, love one another fervently with a pure heart. Love one another fervently with a pure heart. The love we have for our brethren should not be mediocre, lukewarm, casual. It needs to be fervent. And if I see a brother in need, I need to fervently do what I can for their benefit, as much as I can and as I have opportunity. We must love one another sincerely as well. Fervently is one thing. What does sincere mean? Yeah, it comes from inside of us as a reality. It's not superficial. It's not something that's just casual. In 1 John 3, this is not in your lesson book. In this the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. Interesting. Righteousness and love paired against each other. For this is the message you heard from the beginning, we should love one another. Not as Cain, who was the wicked one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brother's righteous. Do not marvel, my brother, that the world hates you. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love the brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer. You know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. This concept of loving is serious business. We need to do it from a true, sincere heart. It's not something we make a sham of or a show of, so it looks like it. It needs to come from inside of us. Similarly, Paul says in Romans 12, verse 9, let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. In honor, giving preference to one another. Not lagging in diligence, that's that fervent. Fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope, patience in tribulation. Continuing steadfastly in prayer, distributing to the needs of the saints, given to hospitality. I think the issue for us is that the way we love the brethren? Do we love the brethren by being kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love? Do we give honor, in honor give preference to one another? Do we excel in diligence? Are we fervent in spirit? Are we serving the Lord in our interactions with one another? I think I said this the other day, and I'll repeat it. If every one of us in this congregation loves the other fervently with a true heart, we're not going to have any problems. We may disagree on some issue, but love will solve that problem. Unfortunately, we find people, and you know, I may be subject to it as well, who love to have my way. This is the way I understand this scripture, and I'm going to have it my way whether you like it or not. You're not going to have peace that way. Now, there are issues and there are principles where we have to stick to what the truth is. But there are other issues that come up that are not that clear-cut. And we need to be careful that we do not tear ourselves apart over matters that are very often judgment and not principle. But even I can disagree with you and you can disagree with me, and we can disagree amicably. And we can discuss and look at scriptures and study together without animosity, without hurting one another, and come to the truth. I think that's true. It's when I want to have my way and I'm going to stir up the works and I'm going to destroy this congregation if you don't go my way. where we have a problem with people loving the brethren. Any comments about that principle? Right.
And so the effort becomes different than the filter is. It's looking at the truth. Unless together, let's figure out what the truth is, then you have a very different conversation.
Right, exactly. That's a good point. Mike.
This is choosing to love you. It's not loving you because you've done something to make me love you.
Right.
It's me choosing consciously to love you and you doing that for me. So even if you act wrong, I can still choose to love you.
Right.
And vice versa.
Right.
Issues, I choose to love you anyway.
Right.
And I think carrying that over to the marriage relationship. So not run act like our marriage as well, but we still choose to love one another.
Exactly. Good point. And the second issue is marriage. And I didn't get into the children. Jesus doesn't talk a lot about children relationships. So I want to preface this with what I'm interested in is discussing the principles, not the exceptions. I think if we understand and really understand the depth of what God intends for marriage, and we agree with that, then the exceptions kind of take care of themselves. There are exceptions, and Jesus talks about them, but that's not what I'm interested in tonight. If you want to study that another time, let me know. We'll have a study on that. It won't take a few minutes to do that, though. Matthew 19. And he answered and said to them, have you not read? Well, let me preface this. They came to him asking him, trying to catch him in a dilemma, as they typically did. Trying to catch him in a dilemma and ask him if it was lawful to divorce your wife, give her a bill of divorcement for any reason whatsoever. So that's the principle he's talking about. So in chapter 19, 1, now it came to pass when Jesus had finished these sayings that he departed from Galilee and came to the region around Judea beyond the Jordan. And the great multitudes followed him. He healed them there. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? And this is Jesus' answer. And it's a positive response. And he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. Now there's talks about discussion from there. I want to leave that for now, though. When Jesus answered this question, he answered it first by telling them what marriage is about in God's heart. What did God say at the very beginning when he instituted the marriage of Adam and Eve? Right. The man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. So that's the principle. And then he says, what's the consequence of that? What God has joined together, you don't separate. Now that's the principle we're talking about. That's the positive perspective that I want you to think about, because that's God's design. That's God's intent. That's what he planned for the fulfillment of a marriage relationship. There ought to be love in that relationship. I think various kinds of love, as the New Testament talks about them, but preeminent in every relationship between people, particularly Christians, is this higher level choosing love that Mike talked about, where you honor that person, you give them preference to that person, you give them whatever you can for their benefit under all circumstances. And I'll say this with relation to what I said a moment ago. If both parties are doing that, things will work out. There's also the affectionate love. There's also the sexual relation love. Those are also mentioned. And those are important as well. But I think overarching all of that is this fundamental love that Christians ought to have for one another. And that will override difficulties that come up. That will override when one is not doing exactly what they ought to be doing. And that does happen. Hebrews 13 says marriage is an honorable thing among all. And the bed undefiled. Fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. Marriage is honorable. By the way, who instituted marriage? God did. God is involved in the joining of the two together. That's why it says, whatever God has joined, let no man separate. It isn't just a legal agreement among two parties over a business deal. It's a combining together of two individuals into one flesh, one being. And that marriage relationship is honorable. It's acceptable. And the relationships that arise from it, including the sexual relationship, is undefiled. Outside of that relationship, what's the conclusion you can draw? It is defiled. The only relationship where men and women can have sexual relationships and be undefiled is marriage. It's the only one. That's what the writer of Hebrews is saying. Romans 7, verse 2, for the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if the husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So that if then, while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. How long does this marriage bond last that God has put together for life? When one party or other spouse of the other dies, then that bondage is divided. And that living spouse is free to marry within certain realms. That's God's principle. Marriage ought to be entered into with a lifelong commitment. And there are times when it gets very difficult. There are times when one party or the other doesn't behave properly. There's times or other when one becomes very difficult to live with. I had a friend in college whose wife ended up in a mental institution. And he was faithful to her, took care of her, and never remarried. There are lots of individuals who have been true to that principle, that this relationship is for life. And I'll tell you, most of us who are older, we know this, but those of you who are younger may not. Things will come up that you never in your life expected. And they're going to put stress on that relationship. I'll give you an example from my daughter. When Josh was 35, was that right? He got colorectal cancer. And that puts tremendous stress on that family for 5 years, where she had to do almost everything. And he was deathly ill. the hospital, surgeries, chemotherapy, radiation. Consequences of that are ongoing. It will be for the rest of his life. A lot of people would say, not for me, I'm out of here. I'm not putting up with that. But that's a marriage for life. So the marriage bond is for life. When one part or the other no longer lives, then that bondage has been separated. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife. Let each woman have her own husband. They're that same business of one man, one wife. Let the husband render his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another except for consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. The beginning of that passage, I think, has to do with the persecutions they were involved with. And Paul's opinion was, under these circumstances, it's better not to get married. But if you have a choice between being married and not sinning sexually, and sinning sexually, get married. Better that way. But once you marry, each man has his own wife, and each wife has her own husband. There's that one man, one woman relationship. There's a union there in which each one has an obligation to the other. I think that passage is pretty clear what it's saying. That there has to be mutual consent if there's going to be abstinence on one part or the other. So do not deprive one another except with consent for a time. That has to be agreed upon as well. And we talk about the man being the head of the household, and Paul talks about that, the man is the head of the family. But in this particular relationship, they're equally responsible to the other one. That's a responsibility we have as man and wife. If you remember the principle, a lot of the exceptions fall away. And the principle is one man, one woman, joined by God into one flesh for life. And they must respect and love one another. The third issue is government. You ever wonder if it's okay to give your taxes to a government that funds abortions? Or promotes drugs, or pays for that sort of thing. I mean, it's easy for us to think, well, we got a pretty corrupt government here. I'm not going to give my taxes. Well, that's not what the Lord said. In John, the 19th chapter, verse 1, then Pilate said to Jesus, are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you? And power to release you. I've got total control of your life, what Pilate's saying. I can turn you loose or I can crucify you. Jesus answered, you could have no power against me unless it had been given to you from above. Where does authority for government come from? It comes from God. God constitutes the authority for government. Government may squander that, and government may not follow God's principles, but government exists at the auspices of God. And Jesus said, you couldn't crucify me, you couldn't release me, either one, unless God had given the authority to do that. Matthew 22. Then the Pharisees went, this is verse 15, then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians saying, by the way, Herodians hated Rome, saying, teacher, we know you are true and teach the way of God in truth, nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. What are they doing there? Yeah, they're buttering him up. They're making him really feel like he can say whatever he wants to say because he's obligated to the truth, which he was. But they're trying to get him to say something that they want him to say. Tell us, therefore, verse 17, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why do you test me, you hypocrites? Show me the tax money. So they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, whose image and inscription is this? And they said, Caesar's. And he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. When they had heard these words, they marveled, left him and went their way. What they wanted him to do was to say one or the other. It didn't matter to them. If they said, pay your taxes, the Jews would have hated it. And they didn't like paying taxes to Rome. If he had said, don't pay your taxes, Rome would put him in jail. Either way, they thought they had him. But what's the principle here for us? Yeah, and that's what Jesus said. Render to Caesar what's Caesar's. Think about what government does for us. Not minutely, but generally. It provides us safety. It provides us some stability monetarily, hopefully, unless you're in Venezuela. It provides for us security. It provides for us a degree of justice, and taxes are paid to do that sort of thing. That's what God ordained it to do, which we'll talk about in a moment. Pay government to do government's work. Give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. At the same time, give to God what is due God. And that's a good point, because what James is saying is Rome was not a pristine, righteous government. I mean, it was probably as corrupt as anything we've ever seen. Think about the Caesars were all pretty much wiped out their own families. The Herods wiped out their whole families. They had all sorts of intrigue and evil going on. And so you can't make that judgment. And Jesus says, government has a role. They tax for that role. Pay your taxes. Romans 13. Verse 1 says, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. Now listen carefully. Rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. You want to be unafraid of the authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is God's minister and avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, we must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For there are God's ministers attending continually this very thing. Render therefore to all their due taxes, to whom taxes are due, customs to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Properly functioning government punishes evil and rewards good. And we need to support that. It's our obligation. He continues in verse 5, therefore you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. Well, I read that already. We need to give to them what is due them. And last, 1 Peter 2. Therefore, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme, or to governors, or to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of those who do good. That's the fundamental function of government with respect to us. To punish evildoers and to praise those who are doing good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free yet not using liberty as a cloak of vice, but as bondservants of God, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. So we draw a line between the local magistrate, county government, state government, federal government. I think this says all levels. That's what our responsibility is, all levels of government. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Unfortunately, governments don't always do what they're supposed to do. And sometimes governments get turned upside down. And they punish good and they praise evil. But we can't control that. We need to keep our obligations toward government. We've got about a minute. Any questions or comments? All right, thank you very much. Talk about the kingdom on Sunday. Yes, you're all. Yeah, I think I should have mentioned that. The one exception is that we have a higher obligation to God than we do to any government. And if government on earth contradicts God's will, God's law, then we have to keep God's will. Thank you. I forgot about that. All right. Now we're up.